Good afternoon, everyone.
Afternoon.
That was juicy. Can I get another one? Good afternoon, everyone.
Afternoon.
I am very energized to see all of you here today. We have an exciting program planned for you today, so let's get it started. First up, I have the pleasure of introducing our divine mistress of ceremonies. Dr. Bryna Helfer is the Assistant County Manager for Communications and Public Engagement. She brings a wealth of experience in the disability community. With over 35 years advancing policies and programs for people with disabilities and older adults, Ms. Helfer started her career working directly with people with brain and spinal cord injuries, helping them return to be active in their community. She has served as the director of the National Center on Traumatic Brain Injury, the director of Project Action to advance accessible transportation nationally, and most recently as the senior advisor on accessibility for the U.S. Department of Transportation. And I will not say that again. She is a member of the National Council on Independent Living and the American Association for People with Disabilities. Bryna herself has a disability and is a passionate advocate for advancing disability rights and policies for full inclusion. Ladies and gentlemen, please rise and welcome Dr. Bryna Helfer.
We're streaming, so I have to use this microphone and stand. I love this high-low. This is a piece of reasonable accommodations adjusting to my height, so that's awesome. If you are up here, you'll see that there's Braille arrows on how to adjust it. All opportunities to help people with disabilities be fully connected with the workplace. And, you know, before we get started, I just want to invite Maiori up here and to join us for the national anthem, and now you may rise. Thank you.
Not staying. Okay. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming.
Amazing to have you join us. You know, you are just incredible. You go to Washington Lee High School. You're just an amazing part of our community, and we so appreciate you joining us today. So another round of applause for Maiori. You know, today we're here to really talk about inclusion and innovation and how innovation and inclusion are connected, especially in the workplace. And I just want to start with a quick video. So, Anna?
Make sure that's the right one. Can you go to the internet? Yep. And just where the blue is. Yep. Right here.
5'11".
Barely 5'4".
I weigh about 170 pounds.
Brown eyes.
Blue eyes.
Brown hair.
Gray hair.
I'm a baseball fanatic.
I'm a wife.
A mom.
A sister.
And a grandfather.
I'm a bodybuilder.
I'm a research analyst.
Small business owner.
Teacher.
Dance fitness instructor.
Film and television actor.
I'm an office clerk.
I'm a copywriter.
I'm a veteran.
I have a prosthetic leg.
I have multiple sclerosis.
I have lupus.
Cerebral palsy.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
I'm blind.
And I'm working in a job I love.
I love because I was given a chance.
Because I was given a chance.
To contribute my skills and talents.
To show my disability is only one part of who I am.
Who I am.
Who I am.
At work, it's what people can do that matters.
For more information, visit whatcanyoudocampaign.org.
So this is really the foundation of National Disability Employment Awareness Month. It's about ability, not disability. And when we think about, how we come to celebrate this important occasion and this important month, it's not just now, but it's year-round. And in 1990, so 27 years ago, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed to advance opportunities for people with disabilities to be fully connected to their communities, right? To work, to play, to live as much as we could, integrated with everyone else in our lives. But today, 27 years later, with all of the reasonable accommodations, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities remains 70%. The barriers to full participation continue to be challenges. Today, we're actually going to hear from advocates, disability leaders. We're going to hear from partners that advance opportunities to think about reasonable accommodations in the workplace, to look at assistive technology that allows all of us to be what we can be and fully participate in our everyday commitment to where we work, live, and play. So I'm really excited that we're gonna just, hopefully all of us will walk out of here thinking about one more thing that we can do that helps everyone do what they can do. So are we together today? Sound good? Awesome. So what we're gonna do, I have the great pleasure of introducing our vice chair of the Arlington County Board. Katie is an amazing leader. She really brings, and in the spirit of full inclusion and participatory government, Katie is really lives and walks that every day. And so as a leader in our community, I invite her to share a proclamation.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is such a pleasure to be here. I'm really looking forward to some of the stories and advice and encouragement and reflections on how far we have yet to go. We're about to hear from today's speakers. I'll be brief, but I do have the pleasure, on behalf of my colleagues on the Arlington County Board, of reading a proclamation. This is Disability Awareness Month, and whereas there are more than 6 million people with disabilities working in communities within the United States, whereas individuals with disabilities possess many skills and talents that contribute to the success of the country's workforce, and whereas the month of October is recognized as National Disability Employment Awareness Month, and whereas Arlington County strives to recruit and hire individuals with disabilities and to provide reasonable accommodations to current employees with disabilities, and whereas Arlington County joins the United States Department of Labor to celebrate the contributions of American workers with disabilities and also to raise awareness of the issues faced by workers and job seekers with disabilities, now, therefore, the County Board of Arlington, Virginia, proclaims October 2017 as Disability Employment Awareness Month in Arlington, and we encourage our residents to recognize the talents and the abilities that individuals with disabilities bring to our workplaces. Thank you.
So, actually, probably present it to Mr. Schwartz here. Fantastic. Mark, come on up here, and let's give the county manager a big round of applause. There's a picture there. Anyways, we have some other members of the executive leadership team in the room, so if you'll just stand, Raul Torres, the head of our Human Rights Department, Lynn Picori, Perfini, our chief of staff, Do I see anyone else from the executive leadership team here? Oh, Jane Rudolph from Department of Parks and Recreation. So thanks for being here. This is amazing. So, you know, as we think about the challenges, I have the opportunity now to introduce you to our chair of our Disability Commission for the county. And I just want to tell you a little bit about Bill. He has a bachelor's degree in psychology. He has two master's degrees, one in philosophy and cognitive science, and another one in organizational development. He has a doctorate degree in human factors engineering. He has worked for NASA, IBM, US Navy, Computer Science Corporation, and DARPA. He's an underachiever, right? Anyways, he's amazing. But what Bill's gonna share with you today is that since he's been in his chair and he's been experiencing his disability, the challenges of continuing in the workplace. So, Bill, please join us.
I'm going to, as you can see, it's hard to get around in the wheelchair sometimes. So I'm going to actually go to the side of this podium rather than in front of it. Well, it's very good to see you all here, and good morning to everybody. And it's my honor to share awareness of disability employment with everybody, and indicate how important it is, or reiterate how important it is. I would like to acknowledge and celebrate that there are currently more.
Bill, are you able to hold it up any closer? There you go. Thanks.
Better. There are currently more benefits and programs for employing people with disabilities, and more employers have become aware of the valuable input of this population and the worthwhileness of hiring people with disabilities. Unfortunately, it does not always work out well, and that is why it's important to be aware of the issue and aware of the importance of keeping to it, because as Brandon brought up, there are national statistics proving that there is an exaggerated unemployment rate among people with disabilities. And that is something that everyone needs to be aware of in order to help ameliorate disparity. And we all need to be aware of it in order to allow it to be a commonplace thing so that we are not focused on the differences, so that we can appreciate the valuable input that the diverse workforce can offer. And there are many particular insights that people with disabilities can share that are worthwhile to the development of many products and much work that we have to do all over the country. With that said, I would like to say that I myself moved to Arlington soon after earning my PhD, enticed by job opportunities. When I got here, I was able to work for the U.S. Navy, and then for an independent contractor, and then for a federal contractor at the Defense Advanced Research Project. And I was laid off due to budgetary constrictions and recalibrations in 2011. And since then, I've been actively looking for a job and meeting with tons of people, doing several programs, doing just about everything that I can think a person should be doing to get this kind of job. And I was married in 2009, so getting laid off a couple years after being married does not bode well. I'm still looking, and I'm still hopeful that things will turn around. And as I said earlier, I think it is a good thing that we're all willing to look and see what the differences are and become appreciative of all the valuable input that is available and the valuable research that the disabled population is that is often overlooked in employment issues. And as Brenda said, I'm also chair of the Owens County Disability Advisory Commission, and I will put in a little plug here. We are committing our main purposes to hear and deliberate and first hear about issues of the disabled community, then pass them on to the board, to be able to guide the board and recommend the board as to what is important and what we're hearing, so that we're kind of a first line of defense, or that's pretty harsh term, but rather we can filter things from the public, give it to the board in a more healable form. And we're always looking to increase our population. We are pretty much a small group of dedicated members that deal with issues constantly, and we would really like to have more people join the board. With or without disability, you can certainly join their commission and speak with us and become part and hear other people's issues and be able to speak to the board about the problems that you were hearing and try and offer suggestions along the way. And with that, I think I will wrap up here.
And again, I'd like to thank you all for showing up.
And other people for listening to this.
And sharing the awareness of the disability bug issue.
Thank you.
So we have an amazing planning committee here, and so I just want to take a minute to acknowledge them. But let's give Bill one more round of applause there. If I might just ask the following people to, where's my great list there? So Mary and Morel, I saw Giselle in the room, Hope, Anna. I'm looking for my list. I know you guys gave it to me. So anyone on the planning committee, if you'll just stand up, and Katie, yep, awesome. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. These guys really have worked tirelessly to bring awareness to not just today, but through the year. And part of their job is also to advance opportunities for people with disabilities, and they're available beyond this day to continue that conversation. So thank you, everyone. Thank you. We also have, Bill mentioned the Disability Advisory Commission, and we have at least two members in the audience, Alexa and Doris Ray. So Doris, raise your hand. Thank you. It's great to have you guys here. As we move forward, I now want to introduce Emily. And Emily Hoban is with our Employment Services Division. Emily has been working as an employment specialist since 2015. She comes from originally working with the Cuyahoga County Board of Developmental Disabilities in their Employment Services Division, and brings a wealth of knowledge to our county in terms of recruiting and hiring, retaining people with disabilities. So thank you, Emily.
Thanks for having me here today. My name is Emily Hoban. I'm an employment development specialist with ServiceSource, and I coordinate the Ticket to Work program at the Arlington Employment Center. As we've established, October is Disability Employment Awareness Month, and I'm here to share some relevant employment data, services available, and a couple of employment success stories with you. Most people with disabilities would rather work than remain unemployed, and they are often able to perform job duties as well as their non-disabled peers. But historically, people with disabilities are underrepresented in the workforce. The Department of Labor Statistics for September of 2017 lists labor force participation of individuals without disabilities at 68.7%, compared with 21.2% for those with disabilities. The unemployment rate for individuals with disabilities was 7.5% compared to 3.9% for those without disabilities. This rate is almost double the rate for the general population. At the Employment Center, we work with people with disabilities who are entering the workforce for the first time, those who are re-entering the workforce after a period of unemployment, and those who are already working but are interested in either increasing their hours or advancing in their careers. Services provided include career planning. For instance, if someone isn't sure what they would like to do, we help them explore different career options, help accessing programs and other resources. For instance, if someone is interested in getting a job and they need a certification, we can help connect them with that. Resume and cover letter assistance, help identifying and applying for positions in line with their vocational goals, learning how to network and talk to employers, help preparing for interviews. So for instance, if someone is called in for an interview with an employer and they're really nervous, I can meet with them to help them prepare, do some role playing and give them feedback. Benefits counseling to understand how earnings impact their benefits, as well as different applicable Social Security work incentives. And talking through work-related problems. So for instance, if someone's having trouble dealing with a difficult coworker or supervisor, we can talk through how to handle that, help requesting reasonable accommodations. And then we provide ongoing support to make sure that things are going well for a person. The Ticket to Work program is administered by the Social Security Administration and provides support to individuals aged 18 to 64 who receive disability benefits and are interested in improving their earning potential, achieving long-term success in the workplace, and reducing or eliminating the reliance on disability benefits. The ultimate goal of this free and voluntary program is to help benefit recipients to eventually become financially independent, thus eliminating their need for Social Security disability benefits, all while allowing them to maintain essential health care coverage through Medicare or Medicaid. Given the safety net provided by the Ticket to Work program, individuals encouraged to realize their full potential to participate in the workforce. An example of someone I've worked with is a young man who is interested in working in an office. He's able to get a job as a file clerk in a law firm. He's now gainfully employed. He's really happy to be working in a professional setting. He's making good money. His family is very proud of him. And he's just really happy to be part of the workplace, belong to a team. Many beneficiaries of disability benefits are concerned about getting a job and risk losing their benefits due to their earnings. For many individuals and their families, qualifying for and securing Social Security disability benefits can be an arduous and frustrating process. The Ticket to Work program and Social Security disability benefits and work incentives allow people to test their ability to work without losing their benefits and ensuring that they have employment supports while doing so. Through the ticket program, beneficiaries work with employment service providers called employment networks or state vocational rehabilitation agencies. The Arlington Employment Center is one such employment network. These services, which I described earlier, are customized to each ticket holder and are in line with their vocational goals. Individuals served through the AEC's Ticket to Work program have found jobs in a variety of fields, including education, retail, childcare, custodial or maintenance, office support, cybersecurity, food service, personal caregiving, and many others. And to wrap things up with a final example, one of the individuals I work with through the program suffers from a debilitating mental health condition. She's had a lot of difficulty holding down jobs over the years and finding her niche in the workforce. Through the ticket program, she's testing out her ability to work as a caregiver and has been employed at this point for almost a year. She's getting a lot of satisfaction working and being able to help other people. She's contributing to her household now and is reducing her reliance on benefits. So I think that's a really great example of why we do all this. She used the ticket program as a bridge to get a good job, and I think that's what makes it all worthwhile. Thank you so much for having me today.
We probably all know someone with a disability in our lives, in our communities, in our families. You know, people with disabilities come in all kinds of different ways, and some disabilities you can see, and some disabilities you can't see. And so that's why it's really important that we focus on the ability and what people can do, help people sort out what they can do with additional assistive technology. So assistive technology, How many of you can think of one assistive technology that you might use every day? Anyone? Okay, so who uses glasses? Assistive technology. Who loves those voice-activated tools on your computer? Those started as a result of reasonable accommodations, right? Universal design. How many people love those curb cuts out there? For strollers, for suitcases? Anyone, if you took the curb cuts away, strollers, shopping carts, yeah? If not but for the Americans with Disabilities Act, we wouldn't have those reasonable accommodations in our community. And so, like I mentioned at the beginning, things that go up and down, rising desks, assistive technology and reasonable accommodations and universal design so everyone can use it and everyone can benefit is really the ticket. Not the Ticket to Work program officially, but it is a ticket, right? So it is the Ticket to Work program for all of us. We all access that every day. And I'm really pleased to have Diane join us. And Diane, come on up here so I can give you. Diane McBride is with the Virginia Department for the Blind and Vision Impaired. And she works here in Northern Virginia with business specialists and employers. And we are, Arlington County is a large employer here in the county. And so you're really here to help employers figure out and employees work with their counterparts and their peers. And she's going to share a little bit with what you guys can do for us.
Thank you so much. People with disabilities represent the largest minority group in the United States, 54 million. With Department for Blind and Vision Impaired, our mission is to assist people with employment, education, and independence. We also have a sister agency, which is the Department for Rehabilitative Services, or the Department for Aging and Rehabilitative Services, and they work with people with all disabilities. And with my agency, we focus on blind and vision impaired. The person who was introducing, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Sorry. She was talking about assistive technology, and we have certainly come such a long way. We have a pipeline of talent that want to go to work. We have folks that have GEDs to people with PhDs. And assistive technology has really enabled people to integrate into the workplace, and it doesn't have to be expensive. Talking about raising a desk to put a wheelchair underneath, iPads, iPhones, Androids have really opened such a world of opportunity for people. When I was with Department for Aging and Rehabilitative Services, had a young man who started a job at a movie theater, and his role was to refill the condiments and the soda machines and what have you. And unfortunately, he was having difficulty remembering the various steps of the job when he would go in. So our rehab engineer or assistive technology engineer, she was able to put together a video that he was able to watch on his iPhone when he went in the morning to remember the steps of the job. In the area of computers, DBVI and DARS were able to provide programs that can be loaded onto computers to voice activate or enlarge print for people. And we work with employers' IT departments to make that work. So the state agencies are here to assist employers. I think one of the barriers that I come up against most often with employers is fear. The fear of what they are, quote, getting into in hiring a person with a disability. So we are there to tear down those fears, show them abilities, not disabilities, and how valuable people are to the workforce who may have a disability and what they can do, not what they can't do. So I thank you so much for this opportunity, and I'm available to share more details if you like after.
Diane, would you be willing to take a few questions?
Absolutely.
Does anyone have any questions about workplace accommodations and just questions in general about
Working with people with disabilities, hiring people with disabilities, working in a team with people with disabilities? Don't be shy. Hope.
One question that often comes up with adaptive equipment is the concept of who pays for it.
Yes.
Or where do you get it, and resources to get the right equipment.
Yes. So with the Department for Rehabilitative Services and DBVI, we have a vocational rehabilitation unit. And after assessment, and if the person requires that piece of equipment in the workplace, that is something that we can pay for, possibly. We do look to the employer. It may be some cost sharing, but it's on an individualized basis. And again, it doesn't have to be expensive. I had a young man, again, when I was with Department for Rehabilitative Services, that secured a job much in a place like this. He worked for a county administrative office on their janitorial team, and he was having difficulty because of his gross motor or fine motor skills in tying the trash bags. Our rehab engineer went out, and for like 5 cents, he was able to craft a little gadget that would assist him in tying that trash bag. So again, it doesn't have to be expensive, and we have engineers and technology engineers that will come out to the workplace, assess the workplace, and support you. You're not alone in when you hire someone with a disability.
Anyone else have a question? Yeah, over here.
Thank you. I feel that, and I might be wrong, and it's more like a question. I feel that when it comes to local, state, and even the federal government level, there are, you know, laws in place that, you know, to protect persons with disabilities, that to hire persons with disabilities, and it happens more frequently. But I, the question is there something in place that would incentivize more of the private sector to hire persons with, you know, tax breaks or, you know, something to that effect that would incentivize them to hire more of
Absolutely. There is the work opportunity tax credit that's available to businesses when they hire people with disabilities. Also, the agencies, as I mentioned, DARS and DBVI, we also have, I don't like to call them incentives, but we have some programs. We have a paid internship with DBVI that we can work with the employer to give the employee a paycheck while they're going through an internship, and we would cover that. We also have on the job training dollars that we can reimburse the employer up to 100% while that person is going through that training. So there are some various programs that we are able to offer to businesses. It's just a matter of us getting out and getting the word that we have, as I mentioned, this pipeline of talent that are ready to go to work, and that we're there to support the employers.
Other questions for Diane? Well, let's give her a big round of applause. Thank you for joining us. It's really great. Before we move to our last speaker, I want to remind everyone that your program on the back of it has a little ticket, and that gets you lunch provided by Freddy's Beach Shack. Is that right? Is it Beach Bar? Sorry. Beach Bar. Freddy's Beach Bar is compliments of them and the committee. So that's on the 9th floor in the employee lounge immediately following our program today. How many of you have learned something new so far today that you hadn't thought about? Anyone? Anyone learned something that you hadn't thought about? And that's really what it is. It's about exploring and asking and having conversations and not assuming that someone can't do it or that there's not a solution to it. That's really what Disability Employment Awareness Month is. That's really what reasonable accommodations and assistive technology is all about. So we have a great resource locally. It's called the Independence Center. End dependence. It is a play on words. The National Council on Independent Living and the Department of Education now actually, it's no longer at the Department of Education, is it? It's in the Administration for Community in the Administration for Community Living at HHS, I apologize. It used to be in the Department of Education. Now it's at the Department of Health and Human Services. Actually funds and supports independent living centers all over the country to help people integrate into their communities. And Alexa is an advocate, peer mentor, and works at the Independence Center here in Northern Virginia. It is our neighbor in the building next door. And she also serves on the Disability Advisory Commission and the Transit Commission, right?
Yes.
Excellent. So give Alexa a big hand. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm glad to be here to speak to you today. As Bryna mentioned, I'm a peer mentor at the Independent Center of Northern Virginia, where I assist people to become more independent based on the goals that they have, some of which can include employment, but can also be other things like, housing, other life skills. But we're talking about employment today. So I wanted to share a little bit of my story. For myself, in some ways, I was lucky. I'd finished graduate school, gotten my master's in philosophy, and I was having difficulty finding work because it was right when the recession happened. And I happened to, at that time, the Independence Center was in a different location, and they had kind of a storefront thing that said people with disabilities ending dependence on the side of the window. And when I was in grad school, I got interested in disability rights and disability advocacy. So I kept, going by this building and going, what's that? What's that? And so I went in, I wandered in and I said, hey, are you guys hiring? They were not, but they were looking for volunteers. And so I volunteered there for a while, and through them, I was able to find some temporary employment opportunities. And a little while after that, when they had a vacancy, they hired me. And so, I really enjoy the job that I do, providing mentoring and support to other people with disabilities. I want to say that I think it is very important for other people like me to have the kinds of opportunities that I had. I think, people struggle with whether it be sending their resumes out, whether it be what do I say in an interview, whether it be when do I ask for accommodations, how do I ask for accommodations, what do I do? And, I would like to see a world where those dismal employment numbers are not so dismal. And another thing that I wanted to mention that folks have mentioned a little bit is that another one of the questions that I get and that I think it's important to think about is, how do I get promoted? How do I advance in my career? Because we have all of these wonderful agencies like DARS and DBVI and organizations, like ServiceSource and other organizations that help to place people. But sometimes people don't have the knowledge and understanding of, okay, I would like to begin a career just like any other person, and I would like to advance over time rather than, I found something and then now what do I do? So I think one of the things that we need to focus on and think about is that a person with a disability is just like any other person. It's not, oh, it was really hard for me to find a job. Now I've got one and I'm, so grateful and I'm done. People want to advance in their lives. People want to learn and grow. People want to, gain respect. People want to earn more. So I think we need to really think about how placement is step one, and having a career and, fully participating in a career is, all the steps after that. So I hope that we will, you know, also focus on that. So that's what I have to say, and thank you very much for listening. And if folks want any resources or information, you know, feel free to give a call to the Independence Center, and I and my colleagues will be glad to help anybody out. Thanks.
That's terrific. And really, we have just these great resources that are available to us right at our fingertips. And so you should never hesitate if you have a question about, you know, something you can do. And we've learned about some of those folks today. So we so appreciate everyone coming in. We have another resource right here on the third floor, and that's our Office of Human Rights. And Anna Maynard's going to come up and share a few things that right here in this building is available at our fingertips. So, Anna, thank you.
Well, thank you, guys. I'm happy to be here. I'm sort of pinch-hitting a little bit. Anthonia Soho was going to talk to you a little bit about what we have available in the Office of Human Rights and EEO to help employees with disabilities, help managers with disabilities, but she had a family emergency and she had to leave. So I'm going to just tell you kind of briefly about what we can do for you if you work in the county and you have a disability and you think you might need a reasonable accommodation. She is able to assist employees with that. It's a confidential process. It's an interactive process. Managers can also contact Anthonia and say, you know, I need some support. I need some help. I have an employee I think might benefit from an accommodation. And she can work together with employee, with the managers, with the departments to try to help those accommodations happen so that employees are able to perform their jobs and to take all you know, benefits that they have in employment and be successful. So you can contact Anthonia. Her extension is 3559. We are located right down at the end of the hall. We welcome visitors. Ring the bell. We'll let you in. We're happy to be a resource for you. And, you know, it's really neat to see. I did Anthonia's job for a long time before I moved into another role, so it's kind of cool to see this event and see how the county is really embracing disability awareness and inclusion. It's a really nice event. I've enjoyed seeing everybody. And make sure you go upstairs and get, what is it? Food. There's food upstairs on the ninth floor. Take your ticket. Freddie's up there with some good stuff, so I'm going to be first in line for sure. But thank you so much. And Anthonia is very sorry that she wasn't able to be here. She worked really hard, I think, on this event, so she was sad to have to leave. But if you have those needs, please contact her office. We're happy to help.
So okay. That concludes our program.
Thank you. Okay, everyone, we are going to come to order, and I am not, we don't have technical difficulties. This microphone is for a recording. It's not for amplification. So I'm going to use my big boy outdoor voice, as we all will as we do this presentation. But I'd like to thank everyone for coming tonight. This is a wonderful turnout, and I was looking at the sign-in sheets and saw that we have representation, not surprisingly, mostly from 22204, so the Columbia Pike area, but I also saw zip codes representing the Metro East section of Arlington. I saw a North Arlington zip code, a Crystal City, Pentagon City area zip code, also Central North Arlington and the Ballston Westover area. So we truly are convening a lot of people for this artist talk with Donald Lipsky. And I want to share a little bit about why I'm here. I'm Christian Dorsey. I serve as one of your five members of the county board, but I'm not really here in that capacity. I'm here because I live very close to the subject site for the art installation that we're going to be talking about on the western end of Columbia Pike. And I am very interested in having and being a part of a community conversation about what is a very unique piece of art and a unique opportunity for us to hear from the artist. By way of a little bit of background, Arlington is home to more than 60 permanent public art projects. And we come by these projects in a variety of ways. Some of them are, you know, these are commissioned to be integrated into various capital projects, as is the case with this one. It's part of a larger, what we call a multimodal project, looking at realigning transportation and putting in some infrastructure on the western end of Columbia Pike. It also comes through the private development process, where even though developers are pursuing the redevelopment of private spaces, we as a fundamental tenant of Arlington, a fundamental baseline of participation, require that that private development create some public spaces, and public art is a central component of that. We also have various other processes of development whereby we achieve the goal of realizing public art, and it also happens through the commissioning of work directly by members of our community. Now, for this project, in 2013, Donald Lipsky was selected to create a piece of public art for our western gateway, our southwestern gateway. So to orient you, if you go all the way to the western end of Columbia Pike, where it meets Jefferson Street, that is the subject area. Right across, of course, is Fairfax County. And this project, like I said, is just a few blocks from where I live, and it will be something that will be seen by presently primarily motorists or people riding in buses as they come into Fairfax, or as Arlingtonians leave the county going to the southwest. So it's a very prominent place, one that is extremely important and serves as a central place of identity, or could serve as a central place of identity for South Arlingtonians. Now, this is something I'd like to just say generally about art. It is inherently subjective, as we all know. Different people look at it in very different ways. By virtue of getting ready for tonight, I was doing a little research into the way artists that we venerate today were viewed by their contemporaries, and was somewhat surprised to learn that the likes of Gauguin, Rodin, Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec, Monet, these were people who we venerate today, but were derided, unappreciated, or not popular during their time. Now, only time will tell whether or not Donald Lipsky is viewed in the same regard as those venerated artists, but he is something a little bit different than that. He is a noted public artist, and as part of that, his work is designed to really react to and interface with the community. So tonight, we have a great opportunity to hear directly from him about the inspiration for his work, the thinking that went into it, and how he expects us as the public to understand, appreciate, and interact with it. But before we hear from Donald, I am going to turn it over to Arlington's Director of Public Art, Angela Adams, who is going to tell us a little bit more about the process for commissioning public art in Arlington, and she will then in turn formally introduce Donald Lipsky. Angela.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Dorsey, and for your support of this project and for agreeing to moderate this evening. I want to also thank our partner in libraries for helping us present this opportunity to this evening. And I also want to just point your attention to some other programs we're going to be doing right here in the libraries. Cultural Affairs, the agency I work for, does more than public art. We present all sorts of art to the public, most of it for free. And we'll be doing a First Friday's Groovin' on the Pike series, which is a music and dance program right here in the library, starting in October, November, and December of this year. I also want to say we do artist talks from time to time. This week we're doing two. So we have tonight, and if you aren't sick of artist talks by the end of this evening, we invite you to come to hear artists from Spain come and speak about their project in the courthouse neighborhood at 11 o'clock on this Saturday. We also have a closing party that's all announced there towards the end of October. So I want to also thank some other folks who are here today. Who were integral, a very necessary part of our process, and that is the Artist Advisory Panel. So Christian asked me to talk a little bit about how we go about commissioning public art, and what I will say is that the public art program is this year 33 years old. We started as a developer-initiated program. The county board passed a policy for public art in 2000. That mandated us to create a public art master plan, which we did in 2004. And we're in the process of updating now. So we ask you, if you have any interest at all in participating in that, please let me know or Deirdre know, and we'll let you know the opportunities for engaging in that. But that will be going to our commissions slowly over the next couple of months. And we're looking to update that, hopefully with the new board next year, early next year. So as part of our program, as Christian mentioned, we have projects that come through private development. We have projects that come as part of county-initiated projects, be they new buildings, open space, or infrastructure. And then we also have community-initiated projects. We have some folks who are working with us to do some murals, especially down in the Four Mile Run Valley area currently. So we act as in an advisory capacity when there's interest there. The county thinks about commissioning a new work of art, it's generally tied to a capital project. We don't run out and build 30-foot, 40-foot art on our own typically. It's integrated into some larger capital project. In this case, it's the Western Gateway Multimodal Project, which is at the intersection, as Christian mentioned, of Jefferson Street and Columbia Pike. So when the community decided that they wanted, and this goes back to the form-based code, those of you who are around for that, and folks who wanted to mark that Western Gateway with something special, it was thought back then to do public art. And so when the time came around to do a capital improvement streetscape project in that area, that's when we remembered that you all asked for public art, and we picked up the theme and worked with that capital project to plan for the art. So we did a national search. Somebody reminded me we had 22 folks who were finalists for the project. We brought together an art advisory panel, and these are the folks I wanted to acknowledge. We have Inta Malice, who participated, Adriana Torres, who's here this evening, Lily Mancilla, I don't know if she's here tonight or not, Tom Ashcraft, who is our outside arts professional, Takis Carantanis, who's here, and also we had staff member Bill Roberts and Mike Garcia from the Fairfax, actually, side of things, because we were right on the line there and wanted to work in a cooperative fashion with Fairfax. So this group of folks helped us review the 22 folks who applied for this project, and then narrowed it down to Donald Lipsky, who we then invited to commission the project. Donald then went through a concept stage, but before that happened, he came and he visited and met many of you, did a lot of research along Columbia Pike, and came up with a concept, which he's going to tell you about tonight, in the context of his work. So you understand a little bit more about Donald, the proposal for Columbia Pike, and also how Donald thinks, how he comes up with these ideas. But it was working with this artist advisory panel that we made this decision to work with Donald and to go with this concept. So without further ado, I will introduce Donald Lipsky. I will say that our collection features as many local artists as it does well-known artists from elsewhere, and of course, Donald falls in that camp. Donald is originally from Chicago. He's the son and grandson of bicycle dealers. He was a history major and anti-war activist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He first discovered ceramics while working with ceramics legend Don Reitz and pursued an MFA in ceramics at the Cranbrook Academy of Art. In the 1970s, Donald moved to New York, gained recognition with his installation Gathering Dust, which first appeared at Artist Space in 1978, and then moved to the Museum of Modern Art. Donald is a three-time National Endowment for the Arts grantee. He became a Guggenheim Fellow in 1988. He was honored by awards from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the Rome Prize of the American Academy in Rome, and Cranbrook's Distinguished Alumni Award. Donald's work is in the permanent collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the former Corcoran Gallery of Art, the Art Institute of Chicago, the Manil Collection, and dozens of other museums. In recent years, his work has focused on creating large-scale works for public places, and some of the most recognizable of these can be found outside of the Denver Public Library. One particular favorite of mine is in the Grand Central Market of the Grand Central Terminal in New York City, Shirshasana, and then Fish at the San Antonio Riverwalk. Also, for those of you familiar with the Convention Center in D.C. and the collection, fine collection that they have there of public art, he did a piece called Five Easy Pieces, which is great fun, and I encourage you to go visit it if you don't know it. So Donald will now tell us more about his work and how he arrived working with the community for the concept for Western Gateway.
I'm mic'd, so
you're
mic'd. I don't need this,
need
right?
Excellent. You're good. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Angela.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it's great to be here talking to you all of you. The hardest thing for me is talking loud enough for all you to hear while I'm in a library, because it seems like I ought to be, you know, that's... my sister's a librarian. I love libraries. I've done some pieces for libraries. And it's great to be here. I've made a few visits to Arlington. And, you know, while you're a complex community and I don't begin to really know about you, everything that I've seen in Arlington, I've loved. I think you're a great, great town. I was just saying to Angela, for a town this size, a couple hundred thousand people, you have so much public art. It's astounding. You might have more public art per person than any place in the world. I think I've got...
Can you turn for you?
Yeah,
you
there we... No, I could do it.
All right.
Thank you. Let's see how this works. Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay. Most of my career, I'm 70, so I've been doing art for a long time. Most of my career I was making work for galleries and museums and that sort of thing. And the last couple decades, I've really turned my attention to making art for the public because I like the idea of having the whole world for an audience rather than just people who are going to galleries and museums. This is not my work. This is Marcel Duchamp, who was a great influential artist from the early part of the 20th century. He was French, although he became an immigrant and moved to New York later in his life. One of the things he is known for is he would just take an object and plunk it down and say, this is art. And this had a big effect on me. I was doing this sort of thing before I knew of him, but when I went to art school, I started to learn about him. At any rate, this was a bottle drawing rack that he took, and he said, this is art, and he signed his name on it in like 1912 or something. I was down in Texas, and in an antique shop, I saw a bottle rack like his, and I took it to a saddle maker and had him cover it in hand-stitched leather. And so that's that. During my career, a lot of what I've done is working with objects, just taking objects that that had some resonance for me and putting my spin on them and trying to make them into artworks. This bed is filled with candles. There's a $20 bill I erased parts of. This is the piece I did at the Corcoran. It's two American flags that intersect that are made out of silk chiffon and then were over dyed with black, so it had sort of a somber feel to it. The Corcoran owns this, and after 9/11 they reinstalled it, which was moving for me. This is the piece at the DC Convention Center. My father being a bike dealer, when I went to convention centers as a kid, it was to the bike show, to the sporting goods show, to the toy show. It was all about fun. So asked to make a piece at the convention center, I made pieces out of what for me were things of joy, you know, like bicycles and guitars, kayaks, tennis rackets, bar stools. This is probably the biggest found object that I've made into a sculpture. It's a GMC bus from the 60s that I cut up and put back together so it tapered towards the end, and it's at a bus terminal in Reno, Nevada. These are like civic clocks, like would be in a town square, that I put these three clocks together for a bus terminal in El Monte, California, which is the farthest west, the farthest east reach of the LA metro bus system. This is at a library in San Diego. They have a big auditorium, even bigger than this one. And I lined the wall with books. It's pretty straight ahead. So thinking about what to do here at the Pike, I started with the idea of a pike. A pike is a medieval weapon that's on the end of a long pole. I don't think they've been used as weapons for a long time, but they're still used ceremonially, like here the Pope's Swiss Guard carries pikes. And even these ones with fancier stuff going on, they call pikes. They use pikes as flagpoles and put finials on the top of flagpoles like a pike. Pikes are tools that all sorts of people use in different walks of life and that they call pikes. These are loggers, firemen, fishermen, boaters. A lot of people use pikes. But the pike I'm talking about here is this. In olden days, when they had a toll road, they would put a pike, one of these weapons, down across the road to block traffic, and then after you pay your toll, they would lift it up. And this is why toll roads are called pikes. This is where it all comes from. This is the Columbia Pike back in the 20s. The Columbia Pike started by Congress decided in 1810 that they should really improve the roads that come into D.C. And they gave money for a few different roads, the Pike going to the west and to the southwest. And this picture is in the 20s. Before 1810, it was just a cow path. And they made it into a respectable dirt road. It wasn't until the 1920s that they actually paved it. And here it is zoomed in on it, and you can see the pole that would become the pike, what they would lay across. Part of my feeling was that on the east, you have Ingo Fried's beautiful Air Force Memorial, and there should be something on the west that is vertical. And this went along with the thinking of all the people I was talking to when we were first talking about this piece. They wanted something that was really visible, that gave a sense of place, that would sort of mark your entry into Arlington. And so I felt something really vertical was needed, and I thought about the idea of a pike. So that's where it all started. This is a sculpture I made at a ballpark in Goodyear, Arizona, which is where the Cleveland Indians do their spring training, which the Cleveland Indians just came off a 22-game winning streak, which is spectacular. This is patterned on, you could sort of get the idea, Brancusi's great work called Bird in Space. He made about a dozen of these, and he had said that he wanted to make a really big one. This is carved of marble and sitting on a little pedestal. So I made more or less a copy of that, except I put stitches in it like a baseball. Driving around at various times, I've come across a wind turbine blade that's being moved from one place to another. And I've been overcome by not only how similar they are to Brancusi's Bird in Space, but how beautiful they are as shapes. To me, it's amazing that this was not made by an artist who's thinking about what something looks like. It's made by engineers, and it's all governed by the laws of physics, what's going to catch the wind the best. So they're such beautiful shapes, and they're coming totally out of mathematics, and I love that. Wind turbines we're going to be seeing more and more of them. They're completely renewable source of power. They're completely non-polluting. If we're going to save our planet, they're going to be part of the solution. And I love referring to that. This little chart shows this is the year 2001, and this is how wind energy capacity has increased in the United States in just that time. And it's going up, 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 up. Virginia has a long history in wind power. There's 1621, the first windmill in the United States was made, was put up near Richmond, and this marks that. This is a windmill in Yorktown in 1780. This is a picture of Washington's accepting the British surrender, and you see the windmill there. There's a map I came across from the Civil War, again by Yorktown, and you can see they've drawn in these windmills for people to help navigate by. If you drive west on the Pike, you've probably seen this. You know where it is better than me, but these are old steel windmills used for pumping water. When you drive out into the Midwest, you see them all over the place because they're still used. So I thought it was interesting that there are still windmills along the Pike. I don't mean this to turn this from an art talk into like an alternative energy talk, but since I'm making it out of a wind turbine blade, I have to just tell you a little bit. This is wind power in the country, and you can see Texas is really totally killing it. Virginia, not so much. The darker colors here have more wind power. The white ones haven't really caught on yet. But this is all changing, and it's going to change fast. This is capacity for wind power in Virginia. And the dark blue places could support 400 big wind turbines per kilometer. Even the light blue spaces can support 100 big wind turbines per kilometer. And so this is all going to happen. This is out near Roanoke. They just approved plans for putting in the first big wind farm in Virginia. In 2015, Virginia was the first state that got permits to put wind turbines offshore in public lands. And they didn't do it then, and Rhode Island beat them, you know. But Dominion is just putting up its first two offshore wind turbines. And I think they're off of Virginia Beach. And eventually there are going to be hundreds of them, and they'll be a big part of the energy power for Virginia. So here is what we're building here. It's simply a wind turbine blade that's up on a pedestal, and it's just put up as this big, beautiful thing. It's a found object. It's recycled. It's emblematic of wind energy. It's emblematic of a pike, but one that's vertical, one that's in the open position that just says, come on in, you know, everybody's welcome. You don't have to pay a toll, even though it used to be a pike. It'll be beautifully lit so that it's a presence 24 hours a day. These are just a few quick drawings to show what it might look like from different directions. We've got this blade. As Angela said, this project started, I believe it started in 2012, so it's been 5 years. I found this beautiful blade that's 50 feet long. It'll go on a stand that's another 10 feet, so it's going to be like as tall as a six-story building. So we've been storing this out in Colorado. To hold it up is sort of an engineering feat. You think about it, a wind turbine blade is made to catch as much wind as it possibly can. So if it can't move and it's just going to be stable, it really needs some serious mechanism to hold it down. So taking a cue from this sort of structure where you have a pipe and then you have these steel gussets that hold it up that are used on high mast light towers and that sort of thing. That's more or less what I'm doing, but I've taken those gussets and made them into a really beautiful, graceful shape. And then I'm putting it on a pedestal. The idea is it does so many things. One is it lifts it off the ground and just takes it out of the realm of the normal plane of where we exist and puts it someplace else, as one does with a sculpture. But practically, you don't have to worry about the sculpture getting destroyed when they're shoveling snow away. It gives a place for people as they're crossing the street there to sit down or rest their packages or so forth. And it also makes an enclosure to hold the lights that are going to light this thing. I guess about 50 years ago, Arlington started to become a haven for immigrants from all over the world. I know this is well documented by this group of wonderful photographers, the Columbia Pike Documentary Project, which started maybe 15 years ago. And there are people here from all over the world. And it's really become a multicultural melting pot. And I wanted to reflect this somehow in the work. I've read places where they called the Pike the world in a zip code, which I love that. So in some of my other projects, I've found a way to involve the community. There's a piece I did in Fort Worth, Texas that's made out of cowboy hats. And all the hats in the sculpture were given to the project by people of Fort Worth. And trying to get a cowboy to give you his hat is not an... I ended up calling the piece Intimate Apparel. But there's 500 stories there, and I've heard a lot of them, and they're all great. There's a piece I did at the library in Minneapolis. They have a fireplace on the arts and music floor, and they asked me to make something to go above the fireplace. I made this sculpture out of violins, and I got all the kids who were in the violin programs in Minneapolis to come and carve their names into the violins. And I can imagine that they're going to come back and show their kids, you know, see, I carved Charlie right into the violin. So thinking about what to do here, I went back to the idea that it's a pike and they used to charge toll. 20 sheep cost 20 cents. You know, a mule and rider, 12 and a half cents. You know, and so on and so forth. A carriage with four horses, 40 cents. Well, that guy could probably afford it, with a four-horse carriage. And I thought that we would cover the base with coins and that the citizens of Arlington would go rummage around in their drawers and find coins from their home country and give me those coins and I would build them into the sculpture. So they'll be epoxied in. We'll do our very best to make it vandal-proof so that someone can't pry the coins off, although it would probably be a lot of work for coins that are not going to be worth that much money. I've worked in this way in various ways over the years. This with little bingo markers. This was with nickels. That's my son who's going to be 26 in March. So this is a while ago. This bench I made for the Central Park Conservancy in New York, who auctioned it off to make money. To support the conservancy, and it's covered with old tokens from the New York subway. It's my old mayor. These are ocean mooring buoys that are covered with pennies that were corroded as if they had been in salt water. This picture's at the White House. During the Clinton administration, they had sculpture on the White House lawn. So one of the things I thought is I'm going to make a coin that might look something like this. And if people give me some coins from their country, I'm going to give this coin to them in exchange. So that's what's coming. I'm not sure when. This all started in relationship to the public transportation you were going to get here that doesn't seem to be coming, which I think is a big disappointment. And the process has drawn out. But I think that next year, this will become a reality. So I'm excited about it, and it's great to have a chance to tell you where it came from and what I've been thinking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Donald. So before we get to the audience, just a couple of baseline questions about your process, if you would. Can you just share some of the lessons you gleaned, some of the observations that you got from talking to people in Columbia Pike, where you sort of did your research, talking to the people of the community? Can you share a little bit about what they wanted to see, or how they viewed this area and how it informed your process?
Okay, the strongest thing I got from talking to people about Arlington and about the Pike was the sense that there are people from all over the world here, which is so unique. You know, I live in New York City, where there's people from all over the world. But to have the concentration that you have here, I understand that a quarter of the people in Arlington speak a foreign language at home. That's astounding. And it's special, and it's not without problems, but it's something I think should be celebrated. The other things I got were that this is really, they wanted a declarative boundary. This is, you are now entering Arlington, and this is someplace special, and it should be something that holds the space, that really makes a statement, all of which led me to the verticality of the piece. And then it was just the idea of a pike. And when, for me, that was sort of an aha moment when I thought, oh, a pike is like this, and then you put it up like this, and it's open and it's welcoming. And that's how the town felt to me, and that's what led me here.
And so for everyone who is here tonight, everybody who watches on Arlington TV, they'll be able to get a sense of that thought process. Does your design include the ability for some sort of an interpretation or a description of some of your vision so that future generations or others who don't have benefit from this conversation can glean some of these insights?
Yeah, probably no. But they could go back and see this videotape. But, you know, Picasso, and in this sense, I'm just like Picasso. Yeah, he said, whatever anybody sees in my work, it's there. And I think, okay, people might not know what a pike means, you know, or that this is a sign of welcoming because it's like this instead of like this. But I think that the piece will just stand on its own and people will see in it what they see in it. It's a beautiful shape. It does refer to this wonderful idea of making energy that doesn't pollute the world. And it'll just be there and it'll be beautiful. Takas was saying before that, you know, basically people are going to be speeding by this in their cars. You know, I was hoping they'd be speeding by it on a trolley, you know, but some people will be walking across the street here. Some people will be riding their bicycles on it. Those people who are the slow-moving people will be the people who see the coins. Maybe people who gave coins for the piece will make a pilgrimage and come here and park the car and get out and walk and sit on it and look and see if they could find the coins they bought, you know, and have a sense of participation, have a sense of ownership. Really understand that the citizens of Arlington are part of the piece. And that I think will be evident without any signage saying, Donald Lipsky wanted you to blah, blah, blah. I was going to say, Takas was talking about how what's undecided is what's going to happen around here. Is there going to be some landscaping? Is it going to develop into a little plaza? Will it perhaps be a place that's actually a center of something rather than just something that you drive by at 40 miles an hour in your car? I don't know, but I hope so.
Now, you had engineers look at it in terms of a base. Have you also had engineers look at the wind turbine blade itself, because it's obviously made to move with the wind and not stand up to it? So I know even when they shut the blades off because the wind's too strong, they still can turn it so it has the least amount of wind resistance on it then.
Right. I've It's a very good question, and I've posed the exact same question to my engineers. And they are confident that it'll be fine. I have a piece that I did in Houston that I've been worried about this last week. I'm doing a piece in Virginia Beach that's going to be on the Lesner Bridge that has a whole lot of surface area that I'm concerned about how that's going to do in a hurricane. I'm not an engineer. I hire people who I think are good, responsible engineers and assume that they know what they're talking about. And they put their stamp on the piece of paper, and I assume that it's going to be fine. I know that this needs a whole hell of a lot of concrete.
All right, so we're going to, I think, have maybe Angela also talk about what we do in terms of indemnifying or you know, foreseeing incidences and how they may be remediated. But I'd like to add to that question, if I could, in addition to the turbine blade, you also have the base of coins, which presumably, even if they're coated in epoxy, are going to shine and reflect light. And how do you envision that impacting the experience of pedestrians and motorists?
Oh, I don't think that'll have any impact at all. They won't be any shinier than a light post would be. And the fact is, I made a sculpture in El Paso last year that's a cloud made of stainless steel panels. And it's at a roundabout, so people really have to be paying attention. And it hasn't been any problem at all. So I don't think that's a problem.
So I'll just say the other thing about public art is the art of compromise. No artist gets to just go out and do whatever they want. There's a lot of give and take. And one of the reasons, is that it's in the public domain. So it has to be safe. It has to be durable. We have to be getting our money's worth. And so, as I said, when we are guests on the teams of these larger projects, we have a whole slew of engineers who happen to be our colleagues who look at projects like this. Traffic engineers, people who do ISD inspections for any kind of structure. And we have, basically, it has to pass muster with our technical advisory team who are basically building this larger project. So anything that they ask us to do, and we ask in some cases Donald to do, to indemnify, to secure, to make sure that this project is safe, we comply with. So that's the good news about public art, is it's done with lots of checks and balances. I think maybe on the downside is it takes a really long time to realize these things, and they're often fairly large budgets too, because I don't know that the artists are getting wealthy on these budgets, but there are a lot of people involved in the team to realize these projects. So that's part of the nature of the work.
For me, I would just say to that, you know, the reason I started doing public art, I initially started it because I wanted to make big things. And if you just make something big as a sculptor, then you have to store it, you know. But making big public art, you know, you've got a client and a place for it to go before you make it. So that's, I think, what first got me hooked on it. But the things about it that I really like are, one thing I like about it is that it's hard. And it's hard because of all the things Angela was referring to. In the days when I was just making things to show in a gallery, I'd be in my studio and I could just do whatever I want. And if somebody's interested in it, great. If they're not, that's great too. Here, you've got to really consider the site. You've got to consider the culture of where it's going. You've got to consider everything. You've got to work with all sorts of people. And I love that. I love that it's hard. Because it challenges me every day. It makes me dig deep. And the other thing I love about it is it matters. These things really have the ability to become landmarks, to become touchstones for their communities, to become something that are sources of pride. If you make something that's in a museum, great. People who go to a museum see it. Here, people integrate it into their everyday life. They become something that they pass all the time. They might start, you know, just take it for granted or not even notice it. But to me, being part of somebody's actual world is an important and a wonderful thing.
Almost sounded like a wonderful concluding statement, but I think we have more questions, if that's
okay. Oh,
okay. All right.
Thanks for coming tonight. I'm fairly familiar with the intersection where this will be installed, and I'm just wondering, it sounds like the logistics are still fairly fluid. Do you know whether you intend to install this piece in the island that is in the middle of the intersection, or do you envision going either to the north or south of the pike itself?
Let me just picture this. That's west. To the north. No, to the south.
So we're north of
to the
pike.
South.
Right.
Yeah.
We're north of the
pike. It will not be on the island. It'll be on the south.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed that there was going to be, that was going itself going to be an island, that there was going to be one lane that went to the south of it, and then the bulk of the street to the north of it. Is that correct?
Okay, and I guess that kind of answers my question. I was wondering that there was going to be some modicum of park space to accommodate people approaching this piece and appreciating the piece, if you've surveyed the site and seen, there's already kind of a small community, including a taco truck, that is a pretty regular feature of that intersection.
They're actually losing the taco truck.
Okay.
Now they're rerouting it.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, if they blame me for
no.
the taco truck, I think if I had to choose, you know. Yeah, it's sort of a toss-up.
Well, probably giving you an idea. You can use a taco truck in your next installation.
Yeah.
And I'm going to guess, Donald, at some point over your career, you've dealt with people who have not been particular fans of your work. And I'm just curious as to, you know, what you, in terms of being a public artist, how would you want a public who may not necessarily see your vision or be enamored of your vision, how would you still like for them to interact with and appreciate the piece?
Well, I always appreciate if they don't try to bomb it. Yeah. I'll tell you, there's only one piece I've done in my life that is roundly hated. And I think it's hated because I don't even want to talk about it. But that's an unusual thing for me. My normal experience and something I would say there's two experiences. One, you make a piece and everybody, oh, that's so nice. And then it's the last you hear of it and nobody really notices it. Or if they do, I don't hear about it. The other is what I strive for, and that is pieces that really become important in people's lives. There's a piece I did in San Antonio. They have something called the River Walk. It's a beautiful civic amenity that was built in the WPA in the 30s. And they decided to extend the Riverwalk, and there was a point where it goes under I-35, a major highway, and they thought it was going to be dark and spooky there, and people would just turn around and go back the other way. And I made a school of fish that are, each fish is about 7 feet long, and there's like a couple dozen of them, and they're hanging under the highway, and they light up at night, and they're beautiful. And turns out that there's a colony of bats that live under the highway. And these bats fly out at night, and every evening people gather, and I mean a lot of people gather there to watch the bats fly out. And the bats fly out, and then the fish light up, and everybody applauds, and then they go out to the cantina, you know. And that, for me, is wonderful. I have a friend who was in San Antonio recently, and he got there, and someone said, well, have you seen the Alamo? And he said, yeah, you know, I saw the Alamo. And they said, well, did you see the fish? You know, it was the second question he was asked.
Hi, my name is Cynthia Connolly. I'm Special Projects Curator of Arlington County. We're here today with Eva Salmeron and Emilio Alarcón. Thank you. From the collective, Spanish collect, Design Collective. So we wanted to thank, first off, MRP Realty, who gave us this plaza for us to work from and position the meeting bowls here. Also, Acción Cultural Española for the funding to bring Eva and Emilio here. Centro Cultural Español from Miami, who are coordinating bringing the meeting bowls to Miami, and then also the Miami Design District. And you guys all here today for the talk. So I think what we'll do is just launch into the talk. And how about if we just start talking about, I'm just completely discombobulated in here. This project, the Meeting Bowls, is a Courthouse 2.0 project with Arlington Public Art. Courthouse 2.0, Reimagining the Civic, is a public art initiative aimed at sparking public conversation about the future Courthouse Square project by exploring the interaction between civic space and civic life in Arlington. Courthouse is a symbolic heart of Arlington, a public town square where you can engage to create, celebrate, or to simply relax. Our purpose with Courthouse 2.0 is to engage people in new and creative ways. So this was the Courthouse 2.0 area that we're looking at. Is, you see the farmer's market over here, and past that is a parking lot. The parking lot eventually will be converted or redesigned into a big public space. What we're doing here is activating these spaces in advance of this newly designed space that will happen in the next 10 years. So on top of this project here, which is marking the corner, sort of a corner point, on the other corner at 15th and Courthouse is a work by Linda Hesch called Civic. So afterwards, you please go over and check out that piece as well. And then the other end of Courthouse, the parking lot, is a mural, a ground mural by an artist named Kate Stewart. So these are some of the projects we're doing to activate the Courthouse area. So I'm going to launch. Yesterday we were talking about a couple ideas. You guys have been a design group since 1999. Is that correct?
Yes, for almost 20 years.
For almost 20 years. So when I was looking at your website, I really loved that first piece you did called the Christmas Attack. And the reason why I loved it is because it was so simple, and it showed this action and a response to the public that I feel as though is indicative of all of your projects thereafter, that you focus on trying to instigate the public in a way to for them to respond, for you to see the response and have them have an experience that they're not even aware the experience is happening. So can you explain Christmas Attack and then some of your other projects that show that style, and then some of your other projects that show that